least 6 Israelis are wounded, and a Palestinian is killed in a shooting near an Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank. France plans to evacuate its nationals from Niger soon in the wake of a military coup against a pro-West government there. And Russia reports new Ukrainian drone attacks on the capital, Moscow, and its vessels in the Black Sea. Hello and welcome live from Tehran. If there's world news, I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. First story takes us to the occupied territories, where a 20-year-old Palestinian man has been killed by Israeli live fire in a shooting near an Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank. 6 Israelis have also been wounded during the incident. Mona Kandil has more.
Israeli military declared that a Palestinian young man arrived at the settlement of Ma'ale Adumim in the occupied West Bank and opened fire at Israeli settlers where in the mall of this Adumim settlement, wounding 6 Israelis. Two of these Israeli settlers had been seriously wounded. He succeeded to the scene. An Israeli police officer opened fire and killed him. Now, the Israeli military says that this Palestinian man is a 20-year-old from East Al-Quds, and he was shot and killed. Hamas movement issued a statement immediately praising this operation and describing it as a heroic operation and as a natural response to the non-stop Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
Well, Israel's Supreme Court says in a historic first, all 15 judges will take part in a hearing on the cabinet's controversial judicial overhaul package, which has met widespread criticism and massive street protests. The court says the judges will discuss petitions to strike down the bill ratified by the Knesset last week, which was the first phase of the legislation. The session will be held on September the 12th. The bill limits the court's powers to void some decisions made by the cabinet. Judicial changes pursued by Netanyahu and his cabinet have sparked an unprecedented crisis in Israel, opening deep divides in society. This has spread to the military, with volunteer reservists and fighter jet pilots threatening not to show up for duty. The same is true in the case of former and current members of Mossad. Over 60 reservists from an elite intelligence program have suspended their voluntary service in protest against the measure. France and Italy are gearing up to evacuate their citizens from Niger after last week's coup in the African country that toppled its pro-Western government. Oh, France announced the decision after protesters stormed its embassy in Niamey on Sunday. That took place during a mass protest to demand the withdrawal of French and other Western troops from Niger. Now, the country is France's last outpost in Africa's Sahel region. France had already pulled its forces out of former colonies Mali and Burkina Faso following coups in 2021 and 2022. Meanwhile, Italy's foreign minister says the country will send a special flight to evacuate its nationals from Niger's capital. Spain is also preparing to evacuate 70 of its citizens by air. Meanwhile, Berlin has urged German citizens to join France's evacuation flights. Burkina Faso and Mali have issued a stern warning against any military intervention to reverse that coup in neighboring Niger. In a joint statement, the two West African countries said any such foreign offensive would be considered a declaration of war against them. Now, the warning comes after West African leaders threatened to use force to reinstate ousted President Mohamed Bazoum in Niger. Mali and Burkina Faso have both been hit by military coups since 2020 that prompted the withdrawal of French forces from the countries. Now the new junta in Niger has warned of a plot by Paris to intervene militarily to reinstate the president.
In its search for ways and means to intervene militarily in Niger, France, with the complicity of some Nigerians, held a meeting with the chief of staff of the Nigerian National Guard to obtain the necessary political and military authorization.
France's President Emmanuel Macron has vowed immediate action if French citizens or interests are attacked. That followed protests against Paris's decision to suspend aid to Niger. The country's ousted pro-Western president has vowed not to resign nearly a week after being detained by the Putschists. That's according to Niger's prime minister. Well, on Monday, the junta also arrested the president of the former ruling party, as well as the oil and mining ministers. Now to Russia, which says its air defenses have repelled another drone strike on the capital, Moscow. One of the targeted aircrafts crashed into a business tower hosting three ministries for the second time in 3 days. Now, the defense ministry called the incident a terrorist attack by lethal drones. It said the drone that struck the tower was hit by radio electronic equipment. Moscow's mayor separately said the building's outer glazing was damaged. The same tower was hit by another drone attack last Sunday. Russian media separately reported a naval drone attack by Ukraine on the country's Black Sea fleet. Ukraine has recently stepped up drone strikes on Russian targets. Moscow has called the attacks acts of desperation, while Kiev says they aim to bring the war to Russian territory. Well, our correspondent in Moscow, Johnny Miller, was earlier with us, and he said Ukraine is incapable of marching on Moscow and is only trying to undermine Russia's internal stability with drone strikes.
Well, yes, this is the second such attack in 3 days, so it's certainly very concerning for the Russian authorities. As you say, hit a skyscraper in a business district. Again, it seems like Ukraine may well be targeting that area. Reports in some Russian channels that a Russian government agency may have been located nearby as well. But it looks like Ukraine is targeting that area. Once again, no casualties, very minor damage. It's mainly a kind of psychological operation, if you like, to try and sow panic or cause internal trouble within Russia, but certainly very alarming for the authorities. If these attacks continue, we may well see casualties at some stage, but we'll wait and see whether this is Ukraine is able to sustain these attacks or whether they are just a couple in the last few days. The only way for victory for Ukraine, or any kind of victory, is for Russian internal troubles. NATO countries were getting very excited about Wagner's recent escapades, their march to Moscow. And I think that Ukraine's strategy is to try to create internal trouble for the Kremlin, hence why you have these attacks. Ukraine doesn't have the capability to march on Moscow or anything like that, but it does clearly have the capability to strike Russian territory. So I think that's what you're seeing. Moscow says it's desperation.
The Nicaraguan president has accused the U.S. and NATO of leading the Ukraine war with the aim of destroying Russia.
This is no longer a war between the Russian Federation and Ukraine. This is a war of the imperialists of the earth led by NATO and the United States trying to destroy the Russian Federation to establish themselves as the masters of the planet. NATO should withdraw and let the Russian Federation and Ukraine agree on peace.
Ortega made the remarks during an event marking the anniversary of Nicaragua's Air Force. He said Managua is opposed to any kind of confrontation, including the Russia-Ukraine war. Over 17 months have passed since the war erupted. Later this week, Saudi Arabia will host a meeting on Ukraine, peace talks with the attendance of representatives from 30 countries. Russia has not been invited to the meeting, but it says any attempt to culminate in peace deserves a positive assessment. Now, the Kremlin, however, underlines that no peace is on the horizon as long as the West continues to use Ukraine as a tool in its, quote, collective war against Russia. And now to India, which is witnessing more communal strife and rioting that have so far claimed 5 lives in Haryana state, close to the national capital of New Delhi. 2 police officers are among those who have been killed. The violence erupted when a right-wing Hindu group, VHP, held a religious procession in Muslim-dominated areas, reportedly chanting hateful slogans. They went on a rampage after the procession was allegedly pelted with rocks. As news of the clash spread, Hindu mobs in the state capital, Gurugram, set ablaze vehicles and shops belonging to the Muslim community. They also torched a mosque around midnight, killing one person and injuring another. Authorities have imposed a curfew. Now, Indian history is rife with instances of religious processions leading to the deaths of innocent civilians. In 2002, some 2,000 people, mostly Muslims, were killed in riots in Gujarat, a western state which was then ruled by Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Now, the head of the Roman Catholic Church has denounced the desecration of the Holy Quran, saying such moves are atrocious and prevent human dialogue. Pope Francis made the comment in response to a letter by an Argentine Muslim cleric who sought the Catholic leader's opinion on the matter. The Pope had earlier condemned the desecrations in an interview with an Emirati newspaper. Several such profane acts were carried out in Sweden and in Denmark over the past weeks. Now, that after authorities in the two European countries issued relevant permissions under the pretext of freedom of expression. On Monday, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation held an extraordinary virtual meeting on the issue. It called for action, whether political or economic, against countries that allow the sacrilege. Well, the Secretary General of the Lebanese Resistance Movement, Hezbollah, has strongly condemned the repeated cases of Quran desecration in Sweden and in Denmark. Speaking in a televised address, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah warned that Quran desecrators will regret their action. He stressed that Muslims must bear responsibility regarding their sanctities. Nasrallah said the faltering stances of Islamic states concerning the desecration confirms that only resistance can defend Lebanon, Palestine, and Al-Aqsa Mosque. He also called for an immediate halt to hostilities against Palestinians. Now, the head of Egypt's Al-Azhar Islamic Center has once again called on Muslim nations to boycott Swedish and Danish products following the Quran desecrations in the two Nordic countries. Sheikh Ahmed Al-Tayyab was responding to a letter from Ayatollah Ali Reza Arafi, the director of Iran's Islamic seminaries, against the sacrilegious acts in Europe. Sheikh Tayyab said Muslims around the world should unite against the challenges targeting their security and sanctities. In a letter to Al-Azhar's chief, Iran's Ayatollah Arafi urged Muslim countries to take coordinated and decisive measures against Sweden and other states that allow the desecration of Islamic sanctities. Over the past month, the Holy Quran was repeatedly desecrated in Sweden and in Denmark, all under government authorization. And the incidents have led to outrage and condemnation worldwide. An Iraqi woman who went viral on social media attempting to save a Quran from desecration in Denmark has been identified. Quds al-Samaraya says she suffered injuries during the confrontation with two far-right elements and was later arrested on theft charges. Robert Carter brings us more from Denmark.
The Arab woman who took on two far-right activists in a bid to save a Quran from desecration in Denmark has been identified. Iraqi-Danish citizen Quds al-Samaraya risked her own life while en route to visit a friend on Monday, the 24th of July. The footage of the incident, which occurred outside Iraq's embassy, went viral on social media. The video clearly shows Quds grabbing the Quran before being wrestled to the ground by the two men. In one instance, one of the desecrators can be seen with his hands reaching for her neck. Police later arrested Quds on accusations she was stealing the Quran from the activists. Speaking to Press TV, Quds explained how the incident left her with minor injuries, but no regrets.
Here the police dragged me, and the man was shouting that I stole his property. I think he was scared because he knew hitting me was wrong, so he had to justify it by saying I stole. As soon as the police heard the word stealing, they immediately put me in handcuffs and gave him back the Quran. The police asked me what happened. I said I saw our Quran being burned, and I just wanted to put it out, and then I saw another Quran with shoes on it, and I wanted to take the shoe off. But I didn't realize that the shoe was nailed on the Quran. I told the police they hit me and strangled me, but they replied with, it's their freedom of speech. So I replied, okay, so it's also my freedom of speech to protect the Quran. I thought the police came to help me, but they turned out to twist the story by saying I was trying to steal.
Goods now faces a day in court, while her injuries have left her struggling to walk. Meanwhile, Muslims across the world remain in a state of anger as calls for serious action and retaliation to Europe's defense of far-right hate speech continues.
Despite Copenhagen officially condemning the incident which occurred just where we stand outside Iraq's embassy a few days ago, that doesn't mean that they've outlawed the practice. And according to reports, several other similar incidents have already occurred since, with far-right activists again targeting the diplomatic buildings of Muslim-majority nations here in the Danish capital. However, this has come at a price. Denmark's defense of the so-called free speech of far-right activists to attack Islam's holy sanctities has led to both Denmark and Sweden's reputation to plummet across the Muslim world. Questions should surely be asked now whether it is indeed within the diplomatic interests of European countries to defend such a fringe extremist practice when, of course, there is so much at stake with economic backlashes from the Muslim world. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
And now to China, where at least 20 people are dead and nearly 20 others are missing after days of heavy rainfall in the northeast. More than half of the deaths have been reported in the capital, Beijing. At least 9 people have also lost their lives in Hebei province. In the capital, rescue teams have been dispatched to help those who remain stranded in trains, and around 150,000 households are without running water. Rainfall has also forced the evacuation of tens of thousands of people from high-risk areas. Water levels in some rivers have reached a dangerous point, prompting authorities to use a flood storage reservoir for the first time in decades. Rainstorms were brought about by Typhoon Doksuri, which hit southern Fujian province on Friday. And with that brings us to the end of this World News edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. A federal judge has thrown out Donald Trump's $475 million defamation lawsuit against CNN, in which the former president claimed the network's description of his election fraud as the big lie associated him with Adolf Hitler. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Washington Post has covered this story and tells us more. A federal judge on Friday, 28th of July, dismissed Donald Trump's lawsuit against CNN, in which the former president said the network defamed him by associating him with Adolf Hitler. Trump argued that by using the phrase "the big lie" in reference to his unfounded claim that the 2020 presidential election was stolen, the network created an unfair association between him and the Nazi regime. Adolf Hitler and Nazi Minister of Propaganda Joseph Goebbels used the term as a propaganda tool that involved repeating a falsehood until the public started to believe it. A quote, "If you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it," is often attributed to Goebbels, though it's unclear where the comment came from. Donald Trump argued that the network's references to the big lie created a false and incendiary association between him and Adolf Hitler, and caused readers and viewers to hate, contempt, distrust, ridicule, and even fear him. However, U.S. District Judge Raj Singhal ruled that the comments did not constitute defamation. CNN's statements, while repugnant, were not, as a matter of law, defamatory, Judge Singhal wrote in his ruling. Donald Trump initially requested a $475 million judgment against CNN. CNN declined to comment on the dismissal of the case. Trump advisor Stephen Chung said in an email that CNN will be held responsible for their wrongful mistreatment of the former president and his supporters, but did not elaborate. Stephen Chung said, "We agree with the highly respected judge's findings that CNN's statements were about President Trump are repugnant. This is the latest in the former president's series of legal woes. Prosecutors announced additional charges against him on Thursday, adding to allegations that he hid and hoarded classified documents at Mar-a-Lago. In March, he was indicted in New York State on charges that he falsified business records in connection with hush money payments made during his 2016 presidential campaign. And a possible third indictment is thought to be coming soon, this one on allegations that Trump tried to overturn the 2020 election, an effort that may have led to the 6th of January 2021 riot at the U.S. Capitol. Donald Trump is also under investigation in Georgia for efforts to reverse his election loss in that state. A jury in New York recently found him liable in a civil case for sexually abusing and defaming a writer, E. Jean Carroll, in the mid-1990s. CNN isn't the only source of comparisons, directly or indirectly, of Donald Trump to members of the Nazi regime. Back in 2020, then-Democratic nominee Joe Biden said then-President Donald Trump was repeating a lie in the same way that Goebbels did in the 1930s and 1940s. Joe Biden also compared Donald Trump to the Nazi propagandist Joseph Goebbels when he called for Trump's impeachment in 2019. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. A federal judge has thrown out Donald Trump's $475 million defamation lawsuit against CNN, in which the former president claimed the network's description of his election fraud as the big lie associated him with Adolf Hitler. In a ruling late on Friday night, 28th of July, U.S. Judge Raj Singhal, who was nominated by Donald Trump in 2019, said CNN's words were opinion and not fact, and therefore could not be the subject of a defamation claim. CNN's statements, while repugnant, were not, as a matter of law, defamatory, wrote Judge Singhal, who sits in federal court in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, near Donald Trump's home at Mar-a-Lago. In a statement, a Trump spokesperson said, "We agree with the highly respected judge's findings that CNN's statements about President Trump are repugnant. CNN will be held responsible for their wrongful mistreatment of President Trump and his supporters." The statement did not say whether Donald Trump would appeal the decision. The lawsuit, which was filed in October of 2022, highlighted five instances in which CNN either published stories or aired comments referring to Trump's assertions about the 2020 election as his big lie. The phrase is also associated with the Nazi regime's use of propaganda. The wording, the lawsuit said, constituted a deliberate effort by CNN to propagate to its audience an association between the plaintiff and one of the most repugnant figures in modern history. But the mere use of the phrase big lie is not enough to give rise to a true connotation, Judge Singhal wrote. No reasonable viewer could or should plausibly make that reference, the judge said. Since launching his first presidential campaign in 2015, Donald Trump has often attacked media outlets whose coverage he dislikes, with CNN, cable news network, a favorite target. Donald Trump is the frontrunner for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination, despite facing both state and federal indictments. Cable news network CNN has also covered the same story. A federal judge in Florida on Friday, 28th of July, dismissed the $475 million defamation lawsuit that former President Donald Trump brought against CNN that accused the network of defaming him by using the phrase "the big lie" and allegedly comparing him to Adolf Hitler. District Judge Raj Singhal, a 2019 appointee by Donald Trump, said that use of the phrase or similar statements are opinion that don't meet the standard for defamation. CNN's use of the phrase "the big lie" in connection with Donald Trump's election challenges does not give rise to a plausible inference that Trump advocates the persecution and genocide of Jews or any other group of people. No reasonable viewer could or should plausibly make that reference, Judge Singhal wrote. Being Hitler-like is not a verifiable statement of fact that would support a defamation claim, Judge Singhal added. The lawsuit is one of many that Donald Trump has filed against media outlets, including CNN, The New York Times, The Washington Post, objecting to coverage during his presidency and in the aftermath of the 2020 presidential election that he lost to Joe Biden. Donald Trump has accused CNN of a campaign of dissuasion in the form of libel and slander, and of creating a false and incendiary association between him and Adolf Hitler. Like Trump and CNN personalities, the court finds Nazi references in political discourse made by whichever side to be odious and repugnant, Judge Singhal wrote. The judge added, "But bad rhetoric is not defamation when it does not include false statements of fact."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. it's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Brothers and sisters, the title of our series of lectures is Karbala, the Enlightened Journey. Just like yesterday, brothers and sisters, I'd like to begin the speech today by reminding us of the merit of this gathering here. I want to turn to the life history of Ayatollah Behjad Marhum. You all know that this great scholar was something special, somebody who reached levels and heights and stations that we can only see glimpses of when we look at his prayer, when we look at the wisdom of his teachings. But his station is something that's beyond our comprehension. What were the habits of this great individual who was with us until not too long ago? One of the customs of Ayatollah Behjad Marhum, we're told by his son, is that every week he would make it a duty of his to commemorate a majlis and to attend that majlis in the honor of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. This custom of his son says, went on for close to 50 years of his life. Even when Ayatollah Behjad was sick, he would insist that this part of his agenda should not be left behind. He has to attend it. And he would insist on it. His son says that he would make it a point to be there on time, from the beginning to the end of the majlis. And at one point, he comments to his son. He says that, my son, it's been 50 years. But if I look at these 50 years, and I look at the importance of these majalis, I would say that even 50 years isn't enough. So my advice to you is that even when I leave this world, you continue this tradition. One of the very interesting and useful things for us on these nights, inshallah, will be to see what was it that led people to abandon Imam Hussein alayhi salam. One of the people who falls into this category was somebody named Ahnaf ibn Qais. Ahnaf is somebody that probably we haven't heard of. He's not somebody that usually comes up in the history of Islam. But his example is super important for us to understand the Jahiliyyah at the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Remember, the Jahiliyyah at the time of the Prophet, as we read in the ayah, was one where somebody in their passion and bigotry, they're willing to take a stand which is unjust. But now things have become more sophisticated. Now you have people who are taking a different approach, but achieving the same result. So who is Ahnaf? Ahnaf is somebody who converts to Islam in a way which is recorded in history. Because he was from a tribe that was holding out. They weren't converting to Islam. They were the Tamimi tribe. And our Prophet had invited this tribe to accept Islam, but they refused until he told Ahnaf, Ahnaf, these are your people. Why don't you go and talk to them? So Ahnaf goes and he tells them that the Prophet of God is teaching you something which is the best of virtues and akhlaq. This is what he wants from you. And he's prohibiting for you what is the worst of akhlaq and the worst of virtues. Why don't you come and accept his message? And because he was from them, they saw that this is something that we can do. And all of them accepted Islam. So he was known in history for being the one who converted or caused the Tamimi tribe to accept Islam. And when the Prophet heard that, what he had done, he said, Allahumma ghfir Ahnaf. O Allah, forgive Ahnaf. He prayed for him. This is considered a mark of respect for him. Now Ahnaf, throughout the years, he's a warrior, he supports Islam, but he's one of those people who has a type of issue with the wilaya of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. So we see in the fitna that happened surrounding Uthman and who he's going to support, and Talha and Zubair, Ahnaf is somebody who takes a stance of neutrality. What he does is, on one hand, he gives the bay'ah to Imam Ali alayhi salam. On the other hand, he tells Talha and Zubair, he says that, you know, you are setting up your stronghold in Basra, I'm from Basra. I have given bay'ah to Imam Ali alayhi salam. I don't wish to fight against him. But at the same time, I don't wish to fight against the mother of the believers. And so what am I going to do? I'm going to take a stance where I'm neither against you, nor am I for you. I'm neither against Imam Ali alayhi salam, nor am I for Imam Ali alayhi salam. So what is Ahnaf doing? Ahnaf is taking the creed of the Murji'ah, and now he's acting upon it. So at a key time when Imam Ali alayhi salam needs his support in the Battle of Jamal, this warrior, this companion who is influential, he's an eloquent person, he abandons Imam Ali alayhi salam. The same Ahnaf ibn Qais, if you go and study his history, when Imam alayhi salam becomes a shaheed, now Muawiyah is the ruler, he makes his way to Muawiyah. And he goes for a private audience. Muawiyah tells him that, wait, aren't you the one who we saw was supporting Imam Ali al-Islam, you know, at this time and that time? Of course, he knew his history, that he was very wishy-washy. And eventually, Muawiyah gives him a good sum of money. And Ahnaf is now somebody who is allied with Muawiyah. And now Ahnaf, of course, we know his history, right? He has this type of approach of neither this nor that. There comes a time when Muawiyah tells him that, Ahnaf, I want you to prove your loyalty to me. I want you to curse Imam Ali alayhi salam. Ahnaf says that, Muawiyah, don't make me do this. Right? I'm your supporter, I've been with you, but this one thing don't make me do. Muawiyah says to him, what if I forced you to do it? What if I told you to go on the minbar and to curse Imam Ali alayhi salam? What would you do? So Ahnaf is clever. He says that, I would go to the minbar and I would tell the people that you say Ameen after whatever dua I make. And then Ahnaf says that what I would tell them is that, O Allah, one, Muawiyah has asked me to curse Imam Ali Islam. One of the two has been unjust towards the other. O Allah, whoever is the unjust one, please remove your mercy from him, curse him, and accept my dua. And when Muawiyah hears this, you know, he's impressed with the cleverness of Ahnaf, and he says that, okay, you're free. Brothers and sisters, you see what's happening here. Right? There's somebody who, at key points in his life, instead of taking a stance, what he's doing, he's backing off, and he's saying that, I'm not going to take a stance. My stance is one of not taking a stance. Now let's fast forward to history, when Ahnaf now is in Basra, and Imam Hussein alayhi salam is now leaving Medina. He writes letters to five people in Basra. One of them is Ahnaf ibn Qais. He invites them to join him. He explains the purpose for his mission. The test has now come to Ahnaf. What is Ahnaf going to do? History says that shamefully, Ahnaf did not even respond to the letter of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And instead, he's reported to have said that we have tested the family of Abul Hasan, meaning of Imam Ali alayhi salam. We've tested them. And we've seen that they're not worthy of being the ones who are the political leaders, nor are they one who are worthy of being having military might, nor are they ones who have any wealth that we can enjoy. And therefore, I will not join Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So he is somebody who represents a trend at that time, the Murji'a trend, which says that in the name of neutrality, we are going to actually support oppression. And when we're now looking and we're trying to examine this new type of jahiliyyah that had descended upon the ummah, we're seeing that this is one of the causes. Now this is very useful for us, brothers and sisters. Why? Why do we do this analysis? Because when we come to these majalis, we want to ask ourselves that how can I be in a position where I avoid being like Ahnaf and the likes of Ahnaf? And all the other new trends and forms of thinking that might have appeared across the times, they would also be classified as jahiliyyah. Who's to say that history won't repeat itself? And when my imam comes, then I would find some type of ideological excuse. I would be justified in taking a position where I would say that I'm right, wherein actually I'm very much in support of those who are unjust.
Oh, Hussein, you live forever. To Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. With hundreds of fires raging, Toronto, New York, and Washington, D.C. have the world's unhealthiest air. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, Toronto and New York stood in first and second place on a list of the world's most polluted urban areas compiled by IQ Air recently. With wildfires burning in Canada, a choking smoke it has spread to major American metropolitan areas. More than 500 fires have been burning across several Canadian provinces for almost a month, spreading an orange-brown haze across eastern Canada and the U.S. Midwest and Northeast. The heavy concentration of particulate matter in the smoke has led public health officials to hand out masks and instruct people to remain indoors. More than 120 million Americans, a third of the population, were living under some kind of air quality alert, CNN reported. Toronto has recently had the worst air quality of any city in the world, according to a live index compiled by IQ Air, a Swiss air filter company. Toronto scored 154 on the company's index, making its air unhealthy for anyone to breathe. New York City and Washington, D.C. followed in second and third place with respective scores of 142 and 120. IQ Air considers an air quality of between 100 and 150 to be unhealthy for sensitive groups. Montreal, Chicago, and Detroit are also in the top 10 on IQ Air's list, alongside cities more commonly associated with air pollution, such as Beijing, Hanoi, and Calcutta. Earlier this week, Chicago and Detroit alternated between first and second place until prevailing winds pushed some of the smoke east. Residents of the Canadian province of Ontario and Ohio River Valley, which includes areas of New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, West Virginia, and Tennessee, have reported smelling burning plastic in the air. According to the Weather Network, this phenomenon occurs when smoke has lingered in the air for so long that the sun's radiation begins to break it down to release toxic benzene and formaldehyde. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has described the 2023 wildfire season as unprecedented and the worst since records began. While wildfire season usually peaks in mid-July, more emissions have already been released this year than any other year on record. According to a report published recently by Copernicus, the European Union's Earth Observation Program, Trudeau has blamed the fires on climate change, while his critics argue that poor forest management and a refusal by the authorities to engage in controlled burns are the true causes of the disastrous blazes. Also, Axios reported the smoke from unprecedented wildfires in Canada triggered poor air quality alerts over swathes of the U.S. again, with multiple cities reporting some of the worst air pollution levels of any major city around the world. While continuing to choke the Great Lakes region and the upper Midwest, the low-lying smoke also drifted southeast and began affecting Ohio Valley and mid-Atlantic cities. Canadian cities, too, were also greatly affected by the smoke, with the Toronto reporting the worst air quality for major cities around the world, according to Swiss air technology company IQ Air. Smoke from unprecedented Canadian wildfires, which have been exacerbated by human-caused climate change and global warming, has repeatedly choked North American cities this summer, and additional rounds of smoke may follow. Canada is experiencing its worst wildfire season on record, driven by extreme heat events and exacerbating drought conditions, according to data from the Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Center, CIFFC. Because of their size, locations, and behavior, the fires are not expected to be extinguished anytime soon, either by firefighters or a major shift in weather conditions until after summer ends, Axios Andrew Friedman reports. Inhaling wildfire smoke when it's present in high concentrations at ground level can cause serious health complications and is especially dangerous for elderly populations and people with heart ailments or asthma. An Air Quality Action Day was declared for all of Northeast Illinois and Northwest Indiana, meaning fine particulate matter and other pollutants could build to unhealthy levels in the outdoor air. Air quality alerts across Upper Midwest are expected to remain in effect, according to the National Weather Service. Chicago had the second worst air quality for major cities around the world, with a 181 or a code red on the Air Quality Index, which is considered dangerous for sensitive groups. Detroit and Minneapolis followed with the second and third worst levels, respectively. Cleveland, which wasn't included in IQ Air's ranking system, had an A QI of 238, which is considered dangerous for all people. An Environmental Protection Agency monitor near Chippewa Lake, Ohio, was reporting an AQI of 309, which is a code maroon, the highest alert level of the index. The Cleveland skyline couldn't be seen from live cameras positioned just a few miles from a shore, while visibility at the city's international airport fell to 1.25 miles multiple times throughout the day. A slight haze and the smell of smoke were present in Washington, D.C., where air quality fell to levels unhealthy to sensitive groups of people. The smoke caused a thick haze in downtown Chicago, reducing visibility at Chicago O'Hare International Airport to 1.25 miles for several hours on several days. Winds have also carried the smoke across the Atlantic Ocean over to Europe, where the sun was partially shrouded in areas of Portugal and Spain. 476 wildfires were burning across Canada, including 234 out-of-control fires. CIFFC reported that 2,957 fires this season have burnt 19.3 million acres, 7.8 million hectares in Canada, which is an area equivalent to all of Michigan's forest land. The reported total number of fires jumped to 2,988, while the burnt acreage went up to around 19.8 million acres, 8 million hectares.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The viewpoints of the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the tragedy of Karbala. Blood gained a victory over the sword on the day of Ashura, and Zainab al-Kubra was the cause of that victory. It was not the case that she had an audience sitting in front of her and listening in silence. She was not speaking the way an orator would speak to his audience. She was surrounded by the enemies, holding spears in their hands. There were also some ordinary people there, the same people who gave up Muslim to Ibn Ziyad, the same people who wrote letters to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and there broke their allegiance to him, the same people who hid in their homes exactly when they were supposed to stand up to Ibn Ziyad. Among the people, there were also some individuals who were not courageous enough to do what they should have done, and they were watching Imam Ali's daughter in tears on that day.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum. أنا لا تشان
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لا تشان أنا لا
تشان Zainab al-Kubra was faced with this motley and unreliable crowd. Yet she spoke in a firm manner. She was an exemplary woman in history. Such women cannot be considered weak. This faithful feminine nature may reveal itself in difficult conditions. She is a role model for all great men and women in the world. She presented a deep analysis of the problems facing the revolution started by the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ali alayhi salam. She said, "You could not distinguish between right and wrong in the fitna. You were unable to fulfill your duty. As a result, they severed the head of the Holy Prophet's grandson and put it on a spear." We can understand the greatness of her character when we consider such things. Zainab al-Kubra salamullah alayha played an unparalleled role on the way of Karbala with Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on the day of Ashura with all those hardships and after Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam had been martyred. It is impossible to find a similar figure in history. Later on, numerous events took place during her captivity in Kufa and in Sham. Because of these great selfless efforts, Zainab al-Kubra gained a prominent position before Allah the Exalted. And this is something that we cannot describe.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.